This one is for you, dear playwright. It's that time of year again. For some playwrights, it's the time when their plays are announced as part of theater's upcoming seasons. For other playwrights, it's the time of year they start receiving invitations to attend summer conferences. But for the vast majority of playwrights, this is rejection season. Emails are flooding into email boxes, sometimes several each day, all with the same message. Thank you for your submission. We received a record number of plays this year for only a few available slots. Unfortunately, yours was not one of them. Happy trails. Keep on writing. Bleep, blop, blorp. I have one email address I use for all of my submissions. Lately, the only emails I receive at that address are rejections and marketing emails because the theaters and organizations have added it to their mailing lists so they can send the periodic salt for my wounds. This is the reality for most of us in the field. There are more writers writing more plays than the industry can sustain. It definitely doesn't help me to know there are thousands of others just like me falling into a whirlpool of despair with each email that comes in, but it's the truth. Rejections alone can kill me, and then I die a double death when I log onto social media and see somebody I know sharing their own rejection. There's really nothing that can be said to help dull this pain. We work in a field where we need to be accepted by others to advance. We can't do this alone, but we somehow must persevere. Two things help me cope. The first is the understanding that the people who are breaking through, getting invited to all these places and getting programmed in various theaters' seasons, usually deserve it. I know a lot of these writers, and they have been working just as hard as I have. They are writing amazing plays. They deserve what they're getting. Okay, I'll admit every once in a while, I'll see a name pop up here and there, and I'll be like, oh, come on! But they're the exception. The second thing is this. I'm not entitled to anything. Theater Bay Area, New Harmony, The O'Neill, none of these places owe me anything. Their rejection of my work isn't personal. I'm just not writing the right play at the right time. Sometimes the play that I think is my best work is just not good enough yet. And sometimes it's just not my time because 7 billion white male writers have already occupied these spaces. My rejections, as painful as they are, make sense. I'm able to carry on because I find joy in writing. I also find joy in advocating for other writers and seeing my friends succeed. I find joy in many corners of the theater world. I write because I want to find a tribe, but writing isn't my only path to a tribe, so I use all the tools I have, I take what comes to me, and I keep writing. In September, I will start sending out whatever new play I have and cross my fingers that by March, that play will have found some fans. In the in-between time, I'll keep circling my joy and crossing my fingers for you, the other struggling playwrights out there. Hi, everybody. This is The Subtext, brought to you by American Theater Magazine, a publication of Theater Communications Group. If you're listening for the first time, welcome. The Subtext is a monthly podcast where I speak with some excellent playwrights about their lives, motivations, favorite breakfast cereals. My name is Brian James Polak, and I'm a playwright who's just trying to figure it all out. This month's guest is Catherine Trishman. Her play, One House Over, just opened at Milwaukee Rep in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. But first, if you have a moment, and I know you do because moments are what people use to listen to podcasts, please rate and comment on iTunes. It helps bring exposure to the show. I want to add, American Theater produces another great theater podcast you should be listening to called Three on the Aisle, a podcast where theater critics Terry Cheechout, Elizabeth Vincentelli, and Peter Marks get together to discuss and maybe even argue a little about the latest happenings. You can find both The Subtext and Three on the Aisle on iTunes. I also want to plug American Theater Magazine's new video series, Token Theater Friends. Twice a month, on the Token Theater Friends video series, theater critics Jose Solis and Deep Tran discuss three shows at three different price points and then pick the best one for the money. You can find the series at americantheater.org and on the YouTubes. Alrighty, now to my conversation with Catherine Trishman. Catherine's plays include How the World Began, Crooked, The Bridegroom of Blowing Rock, Hot Georgia Sunday, The Most Deserving, Holy Laughter, and One House Over. Her plays have appeared all over the country at theaters such as South Coast Rep, Women's Project, Denver Theater Center, Actors Theater of Louisville, and American Theater Company in Chicago, just to name a few. She has received commissions from South Coast Rep, Denver Theater Center, Manhattan Theater Club. Catherine is a recipient of a mid-career artist grant from the Kansas Art Council and the 2012 Otis Guernsey New Voices Playwriting Award from the William Inge Theater Festival. This interview was recorded on February 27th, 2018 in an awesome little conference room overlooking the, and I'm sure I'll butcher this name, the Quadracci Powerhouse Theater at Milwaukee Rep. It was just a few hours before the first preview of One House Over.
Okay.
Which we literally are having coffee right now.
We are.
And actually, we're having coffee in with one of the most impressive coffee shop views you could possibly have. Not that we're in a coffee shop, but
yeah,
we're looking down. We're looking down at the theater.
Mm-hmm.
This is my first time on a road trip to interview somebody.
Oh, that's exciting! And this is the biggest space I've ever had a play in. It's 750.
Really?
Yeah.
Does this seem like a notch in your career belt? Like, do you look at it that way? Like, oh my God, I'm in a space I've never been in before that is this size.
I don't think of it as a notch in my career belt, but I certainly have clocked the fact that this is a big theater with a lot of seats.
Right.
You know, certainly. And that requires a different kind of performance and
mm-hmm.
a sort of ambition
mm-hmm.
That feels different than some of my other pieces.
Do you feel pressure because of that?
No. I don't feel any more pressure in this particular theater than other theaters. No. No.
Have
we started?
We're recording.
Okay.
We're talking now. we'll find our way in. So we are at Milwaukee Repertory Theater, the Rep, as they say, right?
Yes.
But this isn't your first time here, right?
No, so they produced another play of mine several years ago in the smaller space.
Mm-hmm.
They produced my play How the World Began.
Mm-hmm. What was that experience like?
Well, I wasn't here for that rehearsal process. That play, I think it premiered at South Coast Rep.
Right.
And then in London and then New York. So by the time it got here, I just came to opening to say hello to the theater and get
mm-hmm.
to know them. But it was a really nice production, great production values, and I was very impressed with the theater as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
Milwaukee Rep hadn't been on my radar until they did that play of mine, and mm-hmm. I came here and I was like, oh, wow, this theater's great. You know, what a gem.
Yeah, yeah. I've had a lot of conversations about audiences. This is one of the things I've actually been interested to talk to you about because of your experience regionally, nationally,
mm-hmm.
and the fact that you live in Kansas. There's this feeling that I've experienced and through conversations I've had with a lot of playwrights and theater makers that certain audiences matter more. So getting your play in front of the New York audience matters more than getting your play in front of an Omaha audience,
mm-hmm.
right? So if you like, you have this amazing theater for this play and you have a 750-seat theater, and what's the difference in value of 750 people in this theater versus 750 people in any theater in around the country?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. I don't know. I mean, the truth is that I only think about the audience when I'm in previews. You know, when I'm sitting in the theater watching the audience respond to the play, I think about audience a lot, you know, and certainly when I'm doing those last steps on the play in front of an audience, my focus is very much on them and whether or not they're snoring or laughing or leaning forward in their seats.
Mm-hmm.
But when I'm actually writing the play, I don't think about the audience very much. And when I'm marketing the play, I don't know that I think about the audience that much either. I mean, I write to my own taste, mm-hmm. and I just trust that there are other people out there whose tastes intersect with mine.
Right. Right.
You know, I write what I want to see. So mm-hmm. hopefully there, you know, is a group of people who will meet me there.
Well, do you find that there are audiences that meet you there more than others?
That's a great question. I don't know. I think it really just depends on the play. Mm-hmm. If a play, how far along in the play's development, you know, mm-hmm. when the audience meets it, that always has a lot to do with how they respond to the piece. Mm-hmm. The quality of the production. Sometimes the age of the audience matters. Mm-hmm. You know, I think maybe I've found that that matters more than the geography.
Mm-hmm. So you did How the World Began mm-hmm. at South Coast Rep, because that was the world premiere.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And then the next production was New York?
No, it was actually London.
So that's a really interesting juxtaposition.
Yeah, that was different.
What was that experience?
That was different. Well, you know, South Coast Rep is interesting because it has, well, that play is a very political play. It's about sort of how the left and the right can't talk to one another. And surprisingly, it's still relevant. Imagine that. I can't remember the year that we produced it. It must have been like 2011.
2011,
yes, yeah. It was a while ago. But in South Coast has an interesting audience because it's a very theatrically savvy audience because that theater's been there forever doing interesting, you know, groundbreaking work. But it's also a pretty conservative county. Mm-hmm. So the audience is very mixed. And so we had discussions after the play every night in that theater, which were very interesting because people across the political spectrum were in the space. In London, you know, it was like in an off West End funky, you know, equivalent downtown mm-hmm. theater. So I think that the audiences, and it was in London, mm-hmm. were probably much more left-leaning, you know, across the board. And so I think that they probably had a stronger judgment against the more conservative characters in the play.
What about the humor in the play?
Oh, you know, that's always a little tricky. That's always a little tricky.
Did you find different laughs?
I think that that play was certainly at its funniest in New York in terms of the productions that I worked on.
Mm-hmm.
That may just be because I was working with, it was the Daniela Topol, the wonderful artistic director of Rattlestick Theater, directed both the South Coast production and the New York production. So mm-hmm. we had time together to really hone it. And by the time it got to New York, I think that we had really found the humor in the piece and the actors were amazing. And, so the humor really landed in New York, but I don't remember it being funny in London, although I couldn't precisely dissect that, you know, now.
Right, but that's not an emotional memory.
That's not emotional memory, yeah, right.
Right. That's interesting. I wonder if there's a lesson in that, like about reworking your play based on the response of an audience.
Yeah, you have to be careful, I think. I mean, you have to respond to what is actually happening in the room at a given production, particularly with a premiere, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, to just ignore what's actually on stage and how the audience is responding to it in the moment is not going to serve you well. Mm-hmm. You know, you have to respond to that. But I don't know that you could do that in every – I mean, I think you have to be able to take a step back as well, three steps back, and say, I might need to make the change for this production. But that doesn't mean that I need to make that change permanently in the script mm-hmm. for all time,
mm-hmm.
you know. And usually, I mean, fingers crossed, usually a play has about three productions before it goes to print. So you are able to get a little bit of a bird's eye view on the text and maybe what you want that final printed version to look like.
Right, if you're so lucky to get that.
If you're lucky
to get that far, right?
Yeah.
I've talked a lot with playwrights in my personal life and on this podcast about how your play is ready for its world premiere when its world premiere closes.
You know? Right, that is true.
Like, you've yes. learned enough about the play that it's now ready.
That's absolutely true.
And then the world premiere has already been stamped on it, and then how do you get how do you get the production of the play that's now ready to be produced?
Right, that's very true. I mean, you know, obviously there are organizations trying to tackle that, like the, you know,
NPN.
New Play Network. Yeah.
Yeah, and they're doing a pretty fabulous job of it, too.
They are.
I'm going to go back a little bit, okay. And I'm going to talk about how you came to identify as a writer.
Well, I was always a writer, I guess, and then I wrote short stories or poems. I remember, like, writing bad poetry and selling them to my friends in middle school, which seems ludicrous.
Great way to make a buck, though.
I know. I think that they were very sappy love poems. And writing short stories. But I would say more than an impulse to write, I remember about my youth is just an impulse to create. So my first passion was dance, and I would just choreograph dance routines all over the house for a good 10 years. And then that moved into acting. And then even though I was always writing in college, I think that's when I started playwriting specifically and also began to believe that actually this was the art form that I had some talent in.
Where did you grow up?
In Athens, Georgia.
Athens, Georgia. That was where, like, under or school, like, grammar school and high school.
That's right. So I lived in Athens, Georgia until I was 18, which is a very groovy college town where R.E.M. is from.
Right.
And the B-52s.
Right.
And then I went to the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, which is another groovy southern college town. And, so, I mean, both places are very artistic and fun, and I was exposed to all kinds of art and dance, music. It was great.
I have always found playwriting, not that I want to pretend that we are magical unicorns, but there is something that I've always found odd and weird about writing plays, in that it seems like as children, writing short stories seem to be an accessible thing because it's sort of like it's a narrative and we're always reading narratives and studying them. But I've always felt like there needs to be some kind – like there usually is some kind of conscious or subconscious motivation that nudges a writer into drama.
Well, I think it's the – I was just so attracted to the embodied text, right? Like so if I began as a dancer and an actor – the best playwriting to go for the best form of writing to turn to if that's where you began is certainly playwriting because it's embodied and that's still what I love about it to this day. It's so different to see text coming out of a live body that is doing things in front of you than say writing a novel or a short story.
Did you have an arts education going into undergrad?
What does that mean?
Or like was there arts programming in your middle school and high school, was your family interested in the arts?
I would not say that I had an exceptional arts education, like, through the school system, no. And my parents were interesting because they certainly exposed us to a lot of different arts. But, like, for example, my father refused to help me pay for college if I majored in theater.
Really?
Yeah, so I was definitely getting two different messages.
And that was out of a desire to push you into a practical profession?
Exactly. Okay. That's right. He was just very concerned about my financial security. For good reason, it turns out.
Right. Right. But I think I wasn't artistically motivated or theatrically motivated as an undergrad. I majored in philosophy, which is just as useless.
Well, I'm married to a philosophy professor.
Unless, right?
That's right.
Well, you can go down to three paths.
Yeah.
Become a professor, go to law school, or become a priest.
Yes.
Right? These are your three choices.
Yes. He's a little bit of all three of those, actually.
Oh, yeah? Well, he's nailed it. Trifecta. Hat trick. I look back on undergrad, and having taught some undergrads, I see the value is pretty even for any liberal arts degree.
I actually think that's right. So I majored in English, which he approved of. But of course, an English degree is not really any more economically viable than a playwriting, than a theater degree.
Right.
So I think in the end, it didn't really matter.
Right.
And I took a ton of theater courses. But, you know, that is actually where my best arts, where my theater education happened, at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. At the time, and I don't know if they still have this, but they had a lab theater where the undergrads produced, directed, wrote, did whatever, six shows a semester.
Mm-hmm.
We had run of the space. And so that's like a dozen shows a year.
Mm-hmm.
It was just an amazing amount of theater that we created together.
Mm-hmm.
That was the best theatrical education I could have had.
And I think that's actually that kind of like hands-on visceral learning is the way you figure out, one, that you are a theater maker and where your inspiration really drives you in what direction because you get exposed to all of the different things.
That's right. You know, we did everything and it was fantastic. You know, I'm sure most of the shows were terrible, but we were able to take a lot of risk.
Yeah.
And
were you acting in them? Were you writing them?
I acted in them. I directed one. I wrote one. I, you know, did publicity. I did lighting for one. you know, I did everything.
And was it in this process that writing popped for you?
Certainly. I think in college, my primary focus was acting. Mm-hmm. But I think the truth is I just realized even in college, I was a better writer than I was an actor. I remember doing a show, Heathen Valley by Romulus Linney, and I had to, the director made us write like character bios. And I remember him coming to me afterwards. He was like, "Oh my God, this character bio is amazing. It's so beautifully written." Right. You know, like the bio was better than my performance.
Right.
Right. That's telling.
Can you recall the first play where you're like, "Oh, okay, I think I get it."
That I was a part of that or
that
I saw?
That you were writing.
Oh, that I was writing.
Yeah.
Oh, well, probably my thesis play, The Bridegroom of Blowing Rock. It's set in the mountains of North Carolina after the Civil War. And even though it's still, like, when I look at my body of work, I would say Crooked is really sort of the play where I found my voice and moved forward. Mm-hmm. But I think just somehow the process of writing the Bridegroom of Blowing Rock, I became a writer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I learned how to write a play. I learned how to write for production. I learned how to revise successfully. I just learned all the tools that I needed to be a writer moving mm-hmm. forward. And not that I'm, of course, I'm always learning and that changes, but that something really came together for that play where I was like, oh, I know how to do this on
right.
some level.
Yeah. Yeah. And was it, did you have any guidance in that process? Like, did you have a professor or collaborators that were really helping you with those light bulbs that were popping?
To a certain extent. So this is actually during my MFA, which was at the back of the University of Georgia. Mm-hmm. So I went back to Athens for my MFA. And what was great about that program is they did two of my plays on the main stage. So mm-hmm. one play called Before the Fire, which is not worth talking about. And then the second one, The Bridegroom of Blowing Rock, which was my thesis play. And I think it was just that experience of production, and certainly had, you know, professors who were helpful. But mm-hmm. just having a program that committed to producing the work
mm-hmm.
taught me so much. And it taught me how to be a writer. Like, during that program, I learned how to – you just write 5 pages a day no matter what,
mm-hmm.
and you get that thing up on its feet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we were actually talking before I hit record about how there isn't a silver bullet, right? How to become a playwright.
No.
But one consistent thing that I can definitely speak to is a lesson that anybody can take, and that is just keep writing.
Just write and self-produce.
Right. But,
you know.
Like, but that's, I mean, that suddenly, like, there are barriers to getting to the process where you could self-produce, but there aren't barriers. The barriers to write every day are usually self-imposed, right?
That's
like writing those 5 pages or spending an hour or half an hour consistently.
Right. That's certainly true. But when I say self-produce, I don't even mean like you need to go rent a theater in New York or Chicago or wherever. I mean like self-produce, do a reading in your living room, do a reading
sure,
at your public
yeah.
library. That
right.
they are very – self-producing can mean very small, easy things.
Right, yeah. I find it interesting that you got through undergrad, and how much time between undergrad and grad school was there for you?
A couple of years where I worked in various menial theater jobs in New York.
So you went through undergrad a couple of years, motivated to get your MFA as a writer into grad school, and it was at the end, it was the sort of culmination of grad school where it all came together for you. I find that really, really interesting. Like, you weren't, did you think when you were going into grad school that you had your shit together?
Oh, to undergrad or to grad school?
Into grad school.
No, no.
Like I'm a writer now and I get
no.
it. You had more self-awareness than
I mean, I knew that I wanted to do theater, but I didn't really understand how to have a career in theater.
Mm-hmm.
I just didn't understand how that was going to work.
Mm-hmm.
And so I did manage to get myself into assistant, like administrative theater jobs in New York. I was sort of savvy enough to do internships and figure that out. So my first job out of college was as an assistant to Lloyd Richards, the wonderful African-American director,
mm-hmm.
Which was great at the O'Neill. So the first summer after college, I was assisting him. I mean, like personal assistant.
Right.
Not directing assistant.
Right.
I was his personal assistant at the O'Neill. So I got to see, you know, new plays, new playwrights doing what they do best in the American theater. And that was wonderful.
Oh, that's a great
yeah.
exposure to demystifying the new play process.
Yes.
Way, right?
Yes.
Especially at the O'Neill, which is kind of like the ultimate place. Not the ultimate, but like one of the places that playwrights strive to get to, that you had an inside look.
I did, and I didn't even know how important it was when I got the job, to be honest. So that was, I mean, that was just a stroke of luck, really.
Right.
But, you know, it was wonderful. But it was, I wasn't writing plays while I was assisting Lloyd at the O'Neill. I was just taking it all in,
mm-hmm.
you know, trying to figure out where I might belong mm-hmm. in this world.
So what then got you to the decision to go to grad school?
After working with Lloyd and doing other various administrative jobs in theater, I won't list the whole resume, but I did start trying to write plays
mm-hmm.
Beyond what I had done in undergrad. And so then I started applying to MFA programs because what else do you do?
Right.
And I didn't get into a lot of them. I don't even think I applied to like Yale. I can't imagine that I even thought that I could go to some place like that.
Right.
But I did get into the University of Georgia MFA program, and it was free, and it was a free ride, and my parents lived there, so I knew that I could study writing and live in my parents' basement and not take out any debt, you know, mm-hmm. not incur any debt, and figure out if this playwriting thing was really, you know, my cup of tea and what I wanted to do, and I found out indeed that it was. But I didn't necessarily know that going into that program.
What did your parents think of your decision?
Well, I think they were just glad to have me home.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
So it's sort of a trade-off. Well, she's not becoming an accountant.
Right.
But at least she's home.
That's right. So my sister's a doctor. My brother's a lawyer. You know, I definitely come from one of those, you know, families
right.
that just wants everyone to have, you know, secure, high-earning professional degrees.
Right.
Yeah.
And have they seen many of your plays?
They have, and they're very proud. I mean, mm-hmm. I think that they have made peace with my financial insecurity mm-hmm. and are really proud now.
Yeah. I think the pride part comes easy for parents. I think accessing what it is we do is often a challenge. Mm-hmm. And I do talk about this from time to time because of my particular relationship to my family as a playwright. Like, I'm not a playwright in my family. I'm just a person. I'm just like the son, brother, whatever. And we don't talk about it. It doesn't exist because it is mystical. They don't understand the form really. And they're not theater goers.
Uh-huh.
They live in New Hampshire,
uh-huh.
In the woods. There isn't like a theater to go to.
Yeah.
And it's just not part of their regular everyday consciousness. So we don't talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
So this huge part of my life is not like a subject at the dinner table when I go.
Oh, that's wild.
When I go visit. Yeah. And because of that, that's what I bring in to conversations with people like you.
Mm-hmm.
I'm fascinated with the relationship, the playwright part of you relationship with your family or like your brothers and sisters.
Yeah, I think that they're all very supportive now. It just was a journey.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're all coming up to see One House Over here at Milwaukee Rep because they live in Chicago now. So they're all coming up.
Your parents do?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah.
How did this Southern family make its way up to Chicago?
Well, the daughter, who is a doctor, lives in a western suburb of Chicago. So when my parents retired, they moved in across the street from her so she could take care of them.
Oh, fantastic. That's a great situation.
For them, anyway.
But then you've got a sort of like a Midwestern home. Right?
Yes.
Right? Mm-hmm. And when you're coming to a theater like this in Milwaukee.
That's right. I've had quite a few shows produced in Chicago over the years, and this play is actually set in a western suburb of Chicago,
mm-hmm.
In fact, because of my spending so much time there with my family mm-hmm. lately.
Talk a little bit about this play, One House Over. Where did this one come? This is a world premiere.
It is right? a world premiere, but I started it at least 5 years ago. I wrote the first draft of it a long time ago. It's inspired by two immigration stories, that of my grandfather who fled Czechoslovakia in 1939 when Hitler invaded, and then my neighbor and friend who came from Mexico City when he was a teenager without papers in the 1990s. So the play was inspired by these two stories. I started it during the Obama years, and the first draft was just not coming together. So I shelved it, you know, for a couple of years, and then I came back to it. In about 2016.
What was the thing can you now look back and say, what was it that felt like, that made the play feel like it wasn't coming together?
Yes, I had too many characters. I was trying to do too many different things. And then I remember coming back to the script when I had more objectivity and saying, oh, you know, I'm seeing this 90-year-old, you know, Czech man interacting with this 35-year-old, you know, Mexican-American woman. And this dynamic is very interesting. And then that relationship sort of became the core of the play moving forward.
And so tonight's the first preview, right?
Yes.
It's first audience.
Yes.
And how do you feel?
I feel okay. I mean, I'm sure I feel okay. There are certain things that I'm anxious about, without a doubt. But we also are definitely at the point where there's not actually that much I can do.
Yeah.
You know, and we only have three previews. We need to spend our rehearsal time doing a lot of tech stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I have to spend the next 3 days just trying to let go.
Yeah. And is that an easy thing for you?
No. I mean, it depends how it goes. You know, if the audience responds to the play well, it'll be easier to step back. And if I feel like it's, you know, putting everyone to sleep, I'm sure I won't sleep tonight.
Do you ever feel like... you've done the work and they just don't get it?
Who's they? The audience?
They, the audience, the critics.
I don't know that it's ever that straightforward. I do really like to remember my last play that opened in New York, The Most Deserving. I do remember leaving that opening night thinking the director, Shelley Butler, and I did everything we could do. You know, we did everything we could to put our best foot forward. Mm-hmm. And that it was just... a matter of taste from there, you know, moving forward.
Yeah.
And I remember feeling a lot of peace about that.
Right.
I can't say that that happens every time, just for a lot of factors. But I just like to feel like I did every single thing that I possibly could. And that whenever I was bored or found a bit of text either, you know, awkward or boring or whatever, I tackled it.
Mm-hmm.
And then it really is up to the fates.
Have you ever felt like you didn't do everything that you could have?
Yes, but usually that is because of time and a process, not because like, oh, I was just lazy. But for example, if you are spending your previews fixing technical things, a lot of times you can't tackle those text things that you want to tackle. So it just depends, you know, how the schedule unfolds.
Mm-hmm. Have you felt the preview process to be differently beneficial based on the tone of your play? So if you have a comedy versus a drama?
Yeah, that's really interesting. I think that what I learned about comedy is that comedy is very hard to do in small spaces. It's interesting.
Why do you think that is?
Because you can see the other audience members. You can see the actor. The actors can see how the audience is responding for any particular joke beyond just hearing them. And I think it makes the experience of, like, if a joke doesn't land, everyone freaks out a little more.
Yeah.
Because we can all see each other and we can all see the joke not landing. And then when you're in a comedy and jokes aren't landing at the top, actors get tense and then they stop landing throughout.
Do you think it's harder for an audience to laugh even if they find something funny because they can be seen?
I think so. I think it's really tricky. Yeah. And also, there's not a mass, like, so if you're doing a comedy, let's say in the 750 seat house, and not that this play is exactly a comedy because it's not, but let's say I was doing, you know, whatever, a true comedy here. You just have enough people that people are, that you're bound to get, the actors are bound to get some feedback with jokes. But if you're in a small house with 100 people, you know, the odds of those jokes landing with all 100 of those people become increasingly narrow.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I wonder if there's a relationship between the broadness of the humor and the size of the space.
I think that's true too. I think comedy is so hard. And most of my plays are sort of comic dramas or in that in-between space. But the one time, The Most Deserving, in another play called Holy Laughter, the times I've tried to just write full-out comedies, it's incredibly hard.
I think I think comedically, but I can't write comedically, and I don't know why.
Yes,
I don't know why
I
that
know.
Is.
Yeah.
So I am similar to you in that in the writing of my drama, there are moments where I'm like, tension needs to be released here. Uh-huh. I need to find something funny. And I have the skill set to be able to like drop in something that will likely be funny.
Yes.
But to keep that up for an entire play, it's sort of like my white whale in
yeah.
my career. I don't know if I'll ever be able to write a full-on comedy.
Yeah, I think it's very hard. So I think it sounds pretty similar. So I wrote this play, Crooked, which was my breakout play. And I didn't know it was funny at all. And then we went into various productions, and it was very, very funny. And I made me go, well, why was that funny?
Mm-hmm.
And it really did send me on a journey to figure out how to craft jokes, the science of comedy, you
mm-hmm.
know. And
mm-hmm.
so I definitely went down a rabbit trail to figure out how to write comedy, because I was doing it, but I didn't know how I was doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And that I do think that each of my plays are usually ignited by a technical challenge, you know, and that.
What do you mean by that?
I mean, like, so after Crooked, I wanted to write a monologue play. I got sort of obsessed with monologue plays.
Okay.
So I wrote a play called Hot Georgia Sunday. So that's my attempt to write a monologue play. And it's actually like a 6-character play from all kinds of different perspectives.
Mm-hmm.
But I read all these monologue plays and tried to figure out how to do them and what made them successful and what were the pitfalls with them. And so then after I did that play, I mean, I don't know that it's a clear trajectory, but then with The Most Deserving, I with that play, I decided I wanted to figure out how to write a comedy. So that was the process of writing the play. I am very motivated by trying something that I haven't tried before, even if I'm not necessarily, like, I'm obviously not like an avant-garde writer,
mm-hmm.
but within the spectrum of sort of my own voice, I'm always interested in trying something technically different than what I did the last
mm-hmm.
time.
Is there something specific that you're trying to do now, either with this play or something else you might be writing?
That's a great question.
A
so the play, yeah, the play that I'm working on, the newest play I'm working on is called The Dust People. And it is a Western, which is sort of interesting.
Is that the thing?
I
want to crack a Western.
I don't know that I necessarily started with that idea, but now that I'm in the middle of it, I am like, oh, this is a Western. I got to figure this out a little bit.
Is it a period Western, or is it like a Western style?
It's called The Dust People, and it has some period stuff in it, but it's mainly set in the present.
Okay.
And it's more of a stylistic choice than it
right.
is sort of old school Western,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm. I want to go back to something you said a moment ago about Crooked being your breakout play.
Mm-hmm.
I'm always very curious about that moment.
Yeah.
Of breakout.
Yeah.
Which is different for a lot of people and non-existent for a lot of people. And
yes.
then sometimes it's a slow boil where you don't
That's
realize
right.
that it has happened.
Right.
Did it feel like a moment for you?
It did.
Can you talk about that? How did that happen?
I did. So I wrote Crooked. It's a 3-woman play. It's very small and personal. And I wrote it to go to the Edinburgh Fringe Festival with my friends from grad school.
Mm.
You know, just sort of on a lark. I got a grant and took the play to Edinburgh, which was fun, you know, and great. And after that, I didn't think too much of it, because that's why I wrote it, you know. And then at the time, Ariel Tepper, the Broadway producer, was doing this summer play festival in Midtown New York every summer, where she would produce like 8 plays.
Mm-hmm.
You had a small 2-week rehearsal process, and then you had this sort of showcase performance on all that, you know, Theater Row on 8th Street, 8th,
yeah.
8th Avenue in New York. And so it got accepted to that. And, you know, for whatever reason, that was just the moment
mm-hmm.
from that being part of that play festival. I got my first agent. I got my first professional production. It was just a very clear door that I got to walk through.
And you were aware of it while it was happening?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, yes. When you go around town meeting with every agency in New York, you're aware that something different has happened.
Right.
Yes.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
So what did you do with that energy?
I moved to Kansas.
You did what any playwright would do. You moved to Kansas. Of course you did. What a
Not just Kansas, but like rural Western Kansas. Like I moved to the Great Plains.
Yeah. Okay. You've just been doing it your own way. Ever since your dad said, don't major in theater, you're like, sorry.
Well, you know, it's interesting. The truth is, you can have big doors opening for you and still not be making a living wage.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's what happened. You know, I had a... My first agent was at CAA, and I was taking meetings with all these film executives and blah, 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 blah. But I didn't have any money,
mm-hmm.
you know. My husband was adjuncting, and I don't even remember what I was doing. But we didn't have any money. And so, you know, and he's a philosopher. I'm a playwright. We were just
right
broke, totally broke. And so he got a tenure track job in Western Kansas. And you know what? I didn't even hesitate.
Really?
Not a bit. There was not a bit of me that thought we should keep living on the East Coast.
And was there, I mean, was there any tension? Like, was there any guilt from his perspective? I know you can't really speak for him, but.
No, we needed a job. We needed health insurance. We needed that. And I honestly felt like I would get more writing done if I wasn't, I think I was also adjuncting at the time and mm-hmm. doing whatever, that I would get more writing done if we had a little more financial security.
Well, I mean, the irony is we laughed heartily when you're like, I moved to Kansas. But the truth of the matter is you have been able to cultivate a really solid career
yeah.
since moving to Kansas. Or, I mean, with yes. moving to Kansas.
And it is true. I mean, it is very helpful that I had that breakout moment. So by the time we moved to Kansas, I had this big agent. I had a production scheduled in London.
Mm-hmm.
The Bush Theater, which was a very big deal. So it is very, I think that was important to have that in place before I moved to Western Kansas.
Mm-hmm.
But it is also true that I could have moved to Kansas and the whole thing could have just died down and been a little dream, you know.
Sure, sure. I'm curious what artistic life is like in Western Kansas. You know, is there, if you weren't who you are with the connections that you have and the ability to, you know, come to Milwaukee and go to Chicago and New York, et cetera. Would you be able to have an artistic life in Western Kansas?
You know, I have, if you want to have artistic life in Western Kansas, you have to make it
mm-hmm.
Yourself. And that is what my friends and I do there. So for example, we do have a symphony in town, which mm-hmm. is really great. And my friends, the Drabkins, are both string players and just very passionate about classical music. And so they have, you know, helped support and participate and market this, you know, symphony for the whole time that they've been there. And I was like, oh, I saw what they were doing. And so when my friend Kathy asked me to write a play for the symphony, I was like, yes, let's do it. And now all of a sudden I have this great creative project that I'm working on in my small town with other artists who I admire greatly. Mm-hmm. You know, we wrote a grant, we got some money, we did our first one last year, we're doing another one this year, and I'm getting to write a play for symphony, for mm-hmm. a full symphony in a big, you know, house of over 1,000 people that gets full, you know, filled up. So for me, that is a great example of doing art locally. You know, you find your yeah. people and you just do it.
Right. Artists will just find themselves.
That's right. Wherever you are. Wherever
and
you are.
It sounds like there's great support for the arts.
You know, there's some support. There was actually a big New York Times.
I mean, if you're getting 1,000 people showing up.
Yeah, that's true. It's true.
It's kind of amazing.
Yeah, it is amazing. And then the New York Times did a big piece actually on our arts council in Hayes, Kansas.
Hmm.
Because we have managed to, even though the state of Kansas has killed the Arts Council and there's hardly any state funding, locally we've continued to really support the arts well. But part of that is because there is oil money in my county.
Mm-hmm.
So there's some philanthropy that happens in this part of Western Kansas that might surprise you because there's some money.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
How have you found the audiences of Western Kansas responding to things that you write?
Well, it is very different. When I'm writing a play for the symphony, it's for family audiences.
Mm-hmm.
And that is very different than, say, if I did one of my edgier plays in town, which I mm-hmm. just wouldn't do. I'm not interested in that.
Is it a political, religious, like, what is the divide?
Well, I mean, where I don't know. I mean, don't shit where you sleep, right? I do live in a very, you know... conservative part of the world, and not that. But I have to say, it's not so much that. It's more, I'm very vulnerable in my writing and provocative, and I just don't necessarily want to, you know, mm-hmm. put that out where I live. Honestly,
mm-hmm. is there? So, do you feel as if there's like a Kansas you, a Hayes, Kansas Catherine, and a version of you that you reveal elsewhere?
Yeah, probably. I mean, I think that I've always sort of felt a certain duality, mm-hmm. sort of as like the good daughter, the good mother, the good blah, 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 fill in the blank versus the risk-taking artist.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I've always felt that duality in my life.
Mm-hmm.
Whether I've lived in Kansas or elsewhere,
mm-hmm.
because I live my life actually very safely and very, I'm pretty risk adverse personally.
Mm-hmm.
But I like a lot of risk as an artist. So mm-hmm. I think I've always felt that.
Well, and as I get to know you, it kind of makes sense that you as the artist of your family, the one artist,
mm-hmm.
I can see how you would have this sort of duality.
Mm-hmm.
I think, as I understand it, I haven't seen a lot of your plays,
mm-hmm.
But as I've read, there's a lot of writing on the subject of religion.
Sure.
And I'm wondering if that's a subject that you always wrote about, or if that came to you in a play after having writing for a while. What where did that come from?
Well,
that's kind of a lame way to ask the question, but I'm sort of curious how religion became
the thing.
A major subject for you.
Yeah. Well, it's just a major subject for my life. So, you know, some people say that writers write about the same question in every play.
Mm-hmm.
And if that's true, then mine is, does God exist? And if so, what does that mean for us?
Mm-hmm.
And I just think that that's the governing question of my life. That's the governing question of my work. And the thing that I am most interested in. Like, some people are most interested in politics or...
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, relationships or whatever. But that is the single governing question of my life and my work. Now, not all my plays address religion.
Right.
But it's interesting that the most successful ones have.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you think that is?
Because I'm writing from, you know, a true, deeply personal and questing place. And I just find the more vulnerable and honest you are in your work, those are the things that people respond to. And it's interesting with Crooked in particular, it's probably my most personal play, and it's the play that people respond to the most. But I don't think it's the best written. It's not the most ambitious. It's not the best crafted.
Yeah.
You know, there's something a little bit juvenile in the writing, but people love that play. I get letters about that play all the time.
People don't know craft, right? People, like, the response is visceral to
mm-hmm,
plays.
It's visceral,
and
that's right.
It's not always based on that amazing turn of phrase that you have,
yeah.
or this one big twist. It's about how an audience emotionally connects, and
that's
you
right.
just never know
mm-hmm.
how that works. Like, you can go see plays all the time, and the playwright me will sit in the audience and be like, this is a poorly written play
mm-hmm.
and the houses are packed and it's extended for weeks because people are connecting with it.
That's right.
And it's not houses full of other playwrights who are
mm-hmm.
Like snickering about the dramaturgy.
That's right. It's true. People, you know, they love theater that they respond to emotionally.
Yeah.
I think that's very true.
Yeah. Do you keep finding, the same answer to your question? Are you finding different answers to your big question? Does God exist?
If so, what do we do about it? Yeah. Certainly the latter. Like, I feel, I you know, I believe in God. I would, at least most of the time. But what does that mean? How do we know God? Why does God, if you do believe in God, if you have spiritual or religious experiences in your life, why do they sometimes disappear? That's a very interesting question to me. That's what Holy Laughter is about.
Yeah.
The hiddenness of God is very interesting to me. Various theological questions are very interesting to me. You know, why some people, you know, look, there are a vast, you know, majority of people across the planet have some experience of God,
mm-hmm.
you know. But why do some people, you know, but some people don't? I mean, that is a really interesting question to me.
Some people experience the same event, and to one it is God, and to another it is not.
Yeah, or they don't have the God gene. Maybe they don't have the same sort of chemical makeup that makes them respond to spiritual experience in the ways that other people do.
Is it biological? Do you think it's biological?
I don't know. I don't have the slightest clue.
What I love how specific this question is. What do we do about it?
Yeah, I mean, I find that question fascinating. You know, atheists will say, well, there's no evidence for God. But there's a whole vast, you know, proportion of people across the planet who say, but every time I pray, this happens.
Yeah.
Every time I worship God, this happens to me. This is my evidence. And I know that I can't repeat this evidence for you, and I can't make you see this evidence, but it's real. You know, for me, this thing happens when I pray. And I'm very fascinated by that.
This is faith present in all of your characters and all of your stories?
Well, no, certainly not. I mean, like, I think of Crooked. I mean, the central conflict of Crooked is that it's basically sort of a coming of age story, and there's a young writer who basically falls in love with her best friend, who's an evangelical Christian, and her mother is a staunch atheist. Mm-hmm. So you get very different perspectives in that play.
Mm-hmm.
How the world began is also about believers and non-believers. I'm always interested in that conflict.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, like this play, for example, One House Over, it's the religious perspective of any character is not discussed at all.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just not in this play. This particular play is not about that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think we maybe talked about it for 5 minutes in the rehearsal room, like what might be the faith of these characters, mm-hmm. as just sort of a given circumstance, in the same way you might say, where did they grow up? You know,
right? Yeah.
So it just differs play to play. It's just that religion obviously recurs in quite a few of my plays.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything specific I think this might have been before I hit record and started our interview about this idea of the continuum, right? Like, I was telling you how I admire you and all of your accomplishments, and
oh, thanks.
I look up to what you have achieved in your career. And I think the term is you've made it, right?
Oh, well.
Right, and I'm using air quotes,
right?
Because who knows what the hell that means.
Right.
So we're on this continuum. And
that's right.
And I'm wondering if there are things you are aspiring for that you hope to achieve, that you'd like to do in your career.
Well, that's a yes. You know, absolutely. There's so much that I would like to do. I'm writing a novel right now.
Is this your first novel?
It's my first novel, yeah. So that is something that I would like to do. And I think that I'm doing that in part because there's so much that I want to achieve in the theater as well. But it is such a roller coaster. A theater career is such a roller coaster. And sometimes I have a lot of opportunities and sometimes it feels like I don't. And I think that writing a novel is a way to besides just wanting to do it, it's something I've always wanted to do. And it's fun. You know, mm-hmm. I'm actually a writer who likes to write. It's fun. But it is also a way of dealing with those, you know, when I'm, going down the hill mm-hmm. when it comes to opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think the best way to, like, you know, have a good career is to not think about it too much. And, you know, if I'm starting to feel insecure about playwriting opportunities, well, let me do something else, you know, mm-hmm. for a little while. Yeah.
What's the novel? Can you talk about it?
I don't think I'm ready to talk about it, but it's fun.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Do you get the motivation to write a novel by reading novels and thinking, I have this idea? You know, like ideas are best, like story ideas are, some people will write an idea regardless of where it might be best suited and what genre, they'll write it in the genre in which
they do. Yeah.
But did this idea come to you and you thought, that's not a play, that is a novel?
I think actually, again, it started because I wanted to try the medium.
Right.
I didn't have the idea
technical
first.
That technical challenge.
That technical challenge
right.
is where, off. Not always, sometimes I have the idea. That's not always true. But for me, I began with the technical challenge. And then, you know, start mulling on the story.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Reaching back to that moment you talked about with your dad wanting you to have a practical career, not major in theater.
Right.
And you going your own way and doing it anyway.
Mm-hmm.
To success. What would be your advice to your child?
That is a great question.
If they wanted to.
I do. I have two children, and the eldest in particular has artists written all over her. Mm-hmm. You know, she's just, you know, since the time she was three, she's been drawing.
Mm-hmm.
And she clearly has a compulsion to draw. She does it all the time. I think that's, you know, I think her fate is sealed. I think I have a little bit of both in me. Like, yes, be an artist by all means, but like, get your college degree.
Right.
You know, get your MFA. Make sure you can teach as well.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a little bit of both. It's that duality.
Yeah.
Again.
What if your youngest says, you know what? I want to be a playwright. You'd say go for it?
I don't know. That's a great question. I would think about it. I mean, I don't think I would ever say to my child not to do something that they were passionate about.
Right.
But I do think I would warn her. Mm-hmm. Yes. I mean, it's incredibly hard to make a living as a playwright. Like, three people do it. It's very hard. You have to do something else as well. So I think, but that it's interesting, but I sort of think that's true of any life in the arts for the most part, right?
Mm-hmm.
You have to figure out how to pay for your life and also create the art,
mm-hmm.
right? And
mm-hmm.
and that's just true for most artists. You know, obviously there are a select few in any given field who are able to pay for their life with their art.
Mm-hmm.
But most of us just can't.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to figure out how to live your life. And so I wouldn't tell my child or anyone else not to be an artist. Like, being an artist is one of the greatest privileges on the planet.
Mm-hmm.
It's the best thing you can be.
Mm-hmm.
But you do also just have to figure out how you can be an artist and also live your life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and some people really don't mind living, you know, paycheck to paycheck in a big city. You know, for me, the sacrifice I made was I needed to live in a small town where the cost of living was very cheap.
Mm-hmm.
So it's different for everyone, but you have to figure out not just the art, but also the life part.
Yeah.
What about you? What? How do you feel about being a playwright
right
now?
Well, I spent my entire 20s. I'm a late bloomer, and I'm a late bloomer pretty much in every aspect of life,
mm-hmm.
like developing self-awareness and identity and learning how to behave as a kind and empathetic human being.
Yeah.
Professionally, all of these things have come to me really late, and I didn't start writing. Like, my coming to writing was through an urge to just create something, mm-hmm. out of this existential fear of having nothing to do for my entire life other than go to work and come home, go to mm-hmm. work and come home. I needed something, and so I acted and poorly and realized that wasn't satisfying. And then I started to write. When I started to write, I was like, oh my God, I think this might work. This might take.
Yeah.
And it took years before I could self-identify as a writer. And during that whole process of learning how to self-identify and taking pride in it and saying, when somebody says, what do you do? And responding, I'm a playwright. Through that process, I learned that, oh, this isn't going to sustain me financially. I will have jobs, and that's okay. I don't identify myself as the person that does this work at my job that gives me a paycheck. I identify myself as an artist. And that turning that corner in self-identity has brought me so much pride and joy.
That's great.
I am not a successful playwright, and I don't get plays produced all the time, but I write constantly and I'm always trying.
Yeah.
And, and that's what matters to me. And the thing that I have said many times is I will possibly die under a pile of unproduced plays, but that's okay.
Yeah.
Because I understand, there, nothing is given. Nobody's entitled to anything. And,
right.
I find joy in the act
right.
of making it. And I would say that to anybody. Like, I'm teaching a playwriting class starting on on Monday, this coming Monday. And it's going to be a whole bunch of students who have never written before, probably, likely, and who are just generally interested in the form. And I'm writing up my sort of initial lecture for them. And I found this, there's this documentary about Maria Irene Fornes coming out soon. And I watched a little trailer for it. And she has this quote that I'm now going to misquote now that I'm realizing, like, I didn't plant it in my head to pull out right now. But in it, she says, playwriting is not how you'll make a living, but it's how you'll make a life.
Yeah.
And I just love that so much because for those of us in it, for those of us not those three people that do make a living, it is so true. And I think once that clicks in, making a living, you compartmentalize into something else.
Yeah, I think that's right. I love that during that inspiring speech, the soundtrack to the play downstairs piped in.
I know. It's kind of cueing us to wrap it up a little bit, which we should do because I know you've got a lot to do today and this is first preview and tech is starting soon. So I do want to thank you for giving me your time.
It was my pleasure.
Yeah,
thank you,
awesome
Brian.
Awesome meeting you.
Nice to meet you too.
Thank you, Catherine, for generously spending some time with me to talk about your career, your play, and living in Western Kansas. The world premiere of her play, One House Over, is playing in Milwaukee at the Rep through March 25th. For tickets and information, visit milwaukeerep.com. I want to thank the folks at Milwaukee Rep for letting us use their space for this interview and for hosting a great opening night party. If you are in the region, go see this fantastic play being produced in their theater, along with the many, many others coming up. I'm super psyched about their upcoming production of Our Town. Thank you to Rob Weiner-Kent and Deep Tran at American Theater Magazine. I feel honored to be working with you guys on this podcast. And thank you, new and old listeners, for subscribing and for supporting podcasts in general. Stay in touch with me via Twitter at @subtextpodcast or via email, thesubtextpodcast@gmail.com. Congratulations on making it to the end of this episode. Tune in next month when I share the audio from my bronze medal winning bobsled run at this year's Winter Olympics.